You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Dean Kinetter. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, how often do you give yourself a treat? And do you consider it self-care? Jen White shares your stories and why so many struggle to make time for themselves. That's today at 6 on 1A+.
Now, a Canadian-based mining company called Greenlight Metals received an exploratory license to drill for copper and gold in north-central Wisconsin. A license alone, issued in February of this year, doesn't ensure Greenlight Metals will actually do any mining.
Tentatively, Greenlight Metals plans to drill for copper and gold in Taylor and Marathon counties, including in the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. The drilling would occur in the Bend and Reef deposits, where it's said more than 4 million tons of copper and gold are located.
Today we'll get two perspectives on the economic and environmental impacts of potential mining operations.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think a mining project would bring to Wisconsin? Do you think it'd be good for Wisconsin jobs and employment? Do you have environmental concerns? What questions do you have for our guests? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org.
Scott Manley is Executive Vice President of Government Relations for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you and good afternoon.
Well, this is in the early stages here. Everything we're talking about is tentative. What are your hopes, Scott, though, for potentially mining in these areas when it comes to the economy and jobs creation?
Well, I think that it would be a tremendous boost to the area for sure if we ended up mining copper and gold and even some silver at the Bend deposit in Taylor County and primarily gold at the Reef deposit in Marathon County. Obviously, a huge boost to local jobs. These are typically very, very well-paying jobs, much higher wages than the state average, and oftentimes these are union jobs as well. So I think from an economic development standpoint, it would be a real boost for those immediate areas. And then when you start looking at some of the other things that are typically associated with mining operations, like transportation jobs and warehousing jobs and hospitality jobs and so forth, I think it would you would see positive and rippling economic impacts throughout the entire northern part of the state.
In the longer view, Wisconsin had for a long time not quite a ban on this kind of mining, sulfide mining, but close enough to a ban to make it very difficult to open these kind of bans. Can you talk about how the regulatory framework has changed in the state that makes something like this possible?
Well, just as you said, it was called the virtual mining moratorium because it wasn't an outright ban. That's been removed. And, you know, basically, if you want to get a mining permit in Wisconsin, it's a very long and rigorous process that you have to go through that will require somebody to demonstrate that they can do mining in an environmentally safe and responsible manner. And that includes posting financial assurance up front before you even dig the first ounce of ore out of the ground, so that if something happened to the mining company and they had to shut down operations, there would be financial resources available to completely restore and reclaim the land where the mining took place. So I think it's important for listeners to understand that this is the very, very, very early stages of what is a very long and rigorous environmental review process that would take years to complete before any mining would be approved.
Talking to Scott Manley from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce about, as we heard, the potential early stages of mining for copper and gold at two sites in north central Wisconsin. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Rob is with us in Wausau. Hi, Rob.
Hello. Yeah, you know, we're talking about developing gold mines in Wisconsin, and we're probably going to get this pitch that somehow gold is needed for, what, electric vehicles and wind turbines? There isn't anything like that. And no foundry in Wisconsin will use the copper from these mines because they use clean scrap. And I'm wondering why some group like WMC is supporting the short-term profit schemes of a foreign mining company instead of the small businesses and property owners. I mean, how many businesses are worth sacrificing from the outdoor recreation and tourism industry for the sake of letting a mining company dig up our wealth and leave us in economic ruin with contaminated water?
Rob, thanks for the call. Scott, what do you say?
Well, I think the gentleman is really taking probably a 1920s or 1930s view of mining, and where there was virtually no regulation in place. Look, today we've got modern environmental laws. We've got modern technology for mining techniques. This is not your father's or even your grandfather's or even your great grandfather's mining that's done today. And what you can't do in Wisconsin if you're mining is violate any of our air quality, water quality, groundwater standards. You certainly can't violate at the federal level the Clean Water Act or any of the federal environmental standards too. And I think the gentleman fails to understand that, look, copper is a critical mineral for solar panels, for electric vehicle batteries, for wind turbines, for home wiring, for power transmission. You know, gold, everybody who's got a cell phone is walking around with gold in their pocket. The computers that we have today have gold in them. Every car has gold in them. Small appliances have gold in them. Satellites, all kinds of electric devices. So, this is a really critical element, a very critical mineral for our economy. And we could just say, hey, let's keep exporting these critical minerals from other countries that don't do environmental regulation as well as we do, and have better or have worse environmental outcomes, for the planet, because we are, relying on third world country mining. We happen to think that's a bad idea.
Thanks for the call, Rob. We'll go to Mark next in Superior. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you? I kind of agree with what he just said a little bit, because I know that we are promoting electric vehicles so dramatically as the solution to a lot of the problems that we're cutting for the environment. But the very source of those materials comes from the area that we're not willing to have drilling and mining in. And so I think we better either rethink the electrical vehicles or rethink our stance on mining, because as much as we think that we can do both without having the mining, we can't. And we need to have either fall back on the batteries, the electric car, and do something with carbon energy, or we're going to have to agree that we're going to have to get this from the areas that we prize, the northern Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, and northern Michigan. We should not continue to allow countries like Russia and China to supply these materials, because they are not environmentally sensitive, and they are ruining the environment in their world, and that's part of our world also. So I think we better be a little conscious of the fact that if we want electric vehicles, we're going to have mining.
Mark, thanks for the call. Scott?
I think Mark stated it very well, and I would just say it doesn't have to be an either or. Either we have economic development and mineral security and the ability to determine our own fate because we're sourcing minerals here instead of relying on dangerous countries, versus do we want to have a clean environment? It absolutely can be both. And in fact, the laws that apply both in this state and at the federal level of government, the mining laws, require as much. There's nobody who's going to get a permit to mine anywhere in Wisconsin that will require us to sacrifice the environment and our public health in exchange for mining. That is just simply not the way modern environmental law and modern environmental practice works.
Thanks for that call. Scott, just in our last few moments, can you talk about the road ahead for a proposal like this?
Well, the mining process, the permitting process, as I said, is very rigorous, and there's a lot of data collection that needs to take place, including mapping out wetlands and streams and doing soil characterization and in fact, drilling to find out, what type of material you're dealing with in the ground deep below the surface. So there's a lot of I would say data gathering is probably the biggest first step, and then it's analysis of that data that can be used to actually put a permit application together.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Scott Manley, Executive Vice President of Government Relations for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, talking with us today about the economic impact of mining with a couple of proposed sites in north central Wisconsin.
Up next, we'll look at the potential environmental impact of this kind of mining.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. With your hopes for the future of these plans, your fears, call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our look at an exploratory mining permit at two sites in north central Wisconsin, looking mainly for copper and gold. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about the potential for mining. That's 800-642-1234. Dave Bluen joins us now, Mining Committee Chair for the Sierra Club Wisconsin Chapter. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, again, early stages here, exploratory drilling. What are some of your concerns when it comes to this kind of mining in these kind of places?
Sure. You know, exploration itself isn't, you know, it certainly isn't full-scale mining, but there are issues with exploration should it go forward, you know, with any proposal in Wisconsin. There are some basic impacts, and you know, drilling holes for exploration intersects groundwater that that can introduce contaminants into groundwater and connect otherwise disconnected aquifers that can cause cross contamination. I want to bring up, especially because this has been an important and hot topic for Wisconsinites concerned about their drinking water, but exploration for mining uses drilling fluids that include, you know, highly toxic PFAS chemical compounds. So, you know, these are the sorts of things that we don't necessarily want to see introduced into our groundwater and our drinking water. So, you know, as well, there are other impacts to consider: new roads into drill sites and contaminants from the materials that are taken out of the ground that have to be taken care of properly. More importantly, the state DNR really doesn't have a lot of oversight over drilling, and the public has virtually no say over approvals for exploration. DNR does have to have control over reclamation, and that authority is that's about the limit of their authority. And one of our problems that we've seen with historical exploration is that boreholes are often left unfilled for many years before companies are required to fill them.
For the mining projects themselves, our last guest, Scott Manley from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, made the case that mining today isn't what mining used to be. It's safer. We know more about reclamation. There's more safeguards and protections in place. What do you say to that?
Sure. I think in general, that's true. But what makes modern mining different from legacy mining is its scale. It's our ability to move much more material, much lower quality material and process ore that has much smaller percentages of metals in it. And you know, the main increases or I guess improvements in technology in recent years have much less to do with environmental protections and much more to do with improving the technology of the mining itself, meaning that we have reduced labor costs in mining projects by introducing robotics and unmanned vehicles and the like. That are simply about improving the bottom line for mining companies and far less about improving environmental quality or environmental protections.
There's also the argument that, you know, we're going to make stuff out of copper. The copper is going to come from somewhere. Even if there is some environmental risk here, is it better to produce in a place with the levels of environmental protection we have in the U.S. versus places around the world with maybe far less protections?
Sure. And I think that's a legitimate argument if we're talking about strategic or you know, strategic minerals that the country needs for defense or other other uses. It's not so with copper, and that's because copper is, well, the U.S. is a net exporter of copper. We produce 1.2 million tons of copper a year. It's more than enough for our domestic use. And so should, of these two properties that Greenlight Metals is considering, should the Bend deposit with its copper be developed, there's only enough copper there identified so far to cover 5% of U.S. domestic production for a single year. That's a drop in the bucket. And in fact, to go to one other issue that got brought up a little bit earlier, in terms of copper being a strategic mineral for the use, you know, for electric vehicles, for windmills, for other, you know, other changes that we need to see in infrastructure that help address the climate change crisis, you know, we have more than enough to meet the need in the U.S. Based on U.S. Production alone. And copper is less of a critical mineral for things like for batteries and the like. You know, those are other minerals that aren't being produced, such as, you know, for the properties that Greenlight Metals is considering, things like cobalt and lithium, manganese and nickel, none of which are proposed to be developed by Greenlight Metals.
Talking to Dave Bluen, Mining Committee Chair for the Wisconsin Chapter Sierra Club, looking at mining proposals in north central Wisconsin for copper and gold. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jordan is with us in Marengo. Jordan, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I have kind of a couple personal connections directly to this issue. My father was a major executive for a mining supply company, so he got to travel to, you know, Chile, Mexico, the desert southwest of the U.S., seeing these huge copper installations in arid areas. He was very Republican, very pro-business, very let's go get it done. And before he died, he told me this should not be done in areas with groundwater issues because the damage will be permanent. In a lot of areas with groundwater, there needs to be perpetual wastewater remediation. So, you know, it's good that the guy from WMC talks about laws and stuff, but laws don't stop how rock fractures. Laws don't stop how groundwater moves through fractured rock. So there is no real remediation at all.
Jordan, thanks for the call. Dave, what do you think?
Yeah, Jordan brings up a good point that, you know, especially northern Wisconsin is an incredibly water-rich environment. And mining in metallic sulfides is dangerous because the rock, when it's exposed to air and water, the waste rock especially, and the tailings, when they're exposed to air and water, produce acid mine drainage and the resulting heavy metals that spreads on surface water and groundwater. And what's also important about this is that baked into Wisconsin environmental law is the fact that mining underground and open pit is allowed to pollute groundwater at the site and for many square thousands of acres potentially around a mine site. It's allowed pollution, and it was a nod to the mining companies and negotiated by the mining industry with the state of Wisconsin to acknowledge the fact that you can't mine in metallic sulfides or other rock in our state without having to pollute groundwater. It's a simple fact.
Thanks for that call. Peter joins us next in Rhinelander. Peter, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Peter?
I was just curious because I have visited Ladysmith, where the Flambeau mine was located. And when I toured there, they mentioned that there are there's financial backing from the mining company to remediate the pollution that is occurring there. But they also mentioned that the payments only last for about 30 years. And I had wanted to ask the previous guest if anything had changed, or if in reality the burden of all of that goes to the taxpayers after 30 years, or if things have changed.
Peter, thanks for that call. Dave, do you know the time period that remediation money is good for?
Yeah, when Flambeau was first closed, the bonding there for the reclamation work was to be held for 30 years. And it's important to note that the bond for reclamation was specific only to reclaiming the site. In other words, in the very narrow sense of the law for reclamation for mining with Wisconsin, meaning filling up the pit with waste rock, covering it over, regrading it, planting it, and essentially making it look pretty. What the bond doesn't cover is any potential cleanup long term. We no longer have a bonding requirement that would have addressed the need for contingencies like emergency cleanup, that sort of thing. That was repealed along with the Prove It First law for metallic sulfide mining in 2017.
Thanks for that call, Peter. And Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Dave Bluen, Mining Committee Chair for the Sierra Club's Wisconsin chapter. Earlier heard from Scott Manley from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, looking at the early stages of a couple potential mining sites here in Wisconsin. A company approved to begin exploratory drilling tentatively in north central parts of the state.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, financial planning can be stressful and maybe discourage us. We'll talk with a Wisconsin finance expert about staying hopeful and positive when working with our money. That's coming up tomorrow here on the Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Coming up after the news, more than 100 bills have been proposed across the U.S., including in Wisconsin, that would ban gender-related health care for transgender youth. We'll talk to one of the providers of that care about what the bills would mean for the children he works with. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Dean Kinetter. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Dean Kinetter. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a bill to legalize medical marijuana got a hearing in the state capitol this week. We'll talk about the shifting politics of marijuana and efforts to decriminalize weed at the federal level.
First, Republican legislatures across the country, including here in Wisconsin, have introduced over 100 bills that would restrict health care for transgender children and adolescents, including puberty blockers and hormone replacement therapies.
Several states, including Arizona and Alabama, have passed bills into law that would criminalize certain medical treatments for transgender youth.
Medical organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, have said these bills threaten the health and well-being of transgender children.
We're talking about legislation that would ban medical treatments for transgender youth, and we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these bans we're seeing around the country? Are you the parent or caregiver of a transgender child? What's your reaction to Wisconsin and other states introducing bills that would ban puberty blockers and hormone therapy? Would this kind of ban affect your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Dr. Joshua Safer is the executive director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York. He's also senior faculty at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Dr. Safer, welcome to Central Time.
Well, happy to be here.
Before we get into the particulars of the bills popping up around the country and the different kinds of treatments, can you talk about the impact on some transgender kids if they don't have access to age-appropriate treatments like these?
Well, the data that we have are for the period when we were not providing care, when we had statistics like 40% of children in these circumstances considering suicide, considering actual suicide attempts, and certainly self-harm.
I looked at guidelines from an endocrinologist association that you're a member of, and I think people sometimes think these kind of treatments are entered into kind of willy-nilly without a lot of thought. Almost every procedure there includes something like, you know, mental health counseling and evaluation before these procedures, these medications and so forth can move forward. Can you talk about some of the barriers, the steps involved in a lot of these treatments?
I think the first thing that's important to consider when we're thinking about children is prior to puberty, we don't do anything with children other than support them in practical ways and listen to them and work with them. So if someone has a gender identity that's different than the sex that was recorded on the birth certificate than the rest of their biology, then we're talking about wearing certain clothes or wearing a certain haircut, things that are very reversible and where there's plenty of opportunity to think through plans. We follow that at puberty for children who are articulate enough to identify themselves soon enough for us to even act then with puberty blockers, which are, again, a very conservative intervention. It's reversible, essentially, that allows us to be thoughtful and for those kids and their families to interact with the necessary mental health professionals and be methodical and reasoned in their thought process. And really, that's about it for young people, for people who are under age 18, maybe towards later in teenage years, after we've followed these conservative processes, we might consider sex hormones that match gender identity. And there are some elements that are not completely reversible, but it's only after that very long process that I just reviewed.
And I think people, when they think of procedures, they might think of gender reassignment surgeries. If I'm reading guidelines correctly, that doesn't happen until age 18.
For the most part, that's correct. The two exceptions for what we would call gender-affirming surgeries would be in the case of chest masculinizing surgeries for the transgender boys, so female to male, where in someone where gender identity is clear, where all of the methodical process has happened, and where all are on board in a supportive way, a chest reconstruction surgery could happen at a younger age, maybe age 16. And then the other exception that's out there is with transgender young women who might want vaginoplasty en route to college or some similar circumstance like that. Again, someone with gender identity well established, with a good conservative approach having been taken for an extended period of time. Sometimes it is convenient for the purposes of perhaps having the parents be the caretakers rather than having this person have a surgery and then go off to college. Depending upon when their birthday is, they might technically have that surgery a little bit before the age of 18. But those are the only two exceptions.
We're talking to Dr. Joshua Safer, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York, looking at medical treatments for transgender youth, what is available, what's not available to them. As states around the country take action, bills introduced, executive actions taken by governors limiting, in some cases criminalizing these kind of procedures, you can join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Safer, looking at a state like Texas, now this is an executive action suggesting that parents who are seeking out this kind of gender-affirming care should be investigated for child abuse. What is your response to that move in that state? Currently, I believe, blocked by a judge.
I am baffled. I continue to be baffled by attempts to politicize what is medical care. The medical organizations involved are filled with thoughtful, conservative science-informed people. And the idea that you would target anyone to deny them medical care, and that you would target parents to deny children care, or that you would target medical professionals in order to prevent them from caring for their patients, essentially violating their professional oath, is mysterious to me, to say the least.
I want to look more closely at some of the treatments you mentioned. Puberty blockers, as you said, reversible over time, but any medication is going to come with side effects. Can you weigh the costs and benefits of puberty blockers?
Puberty blockers for, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing in terms of who were envisioning getting these puberty blockers. I think the anxiety for many is that there will be children who are not transgender, or maybe they are transgender, but they don't want treatment after all, who will be started on puberty blockers. And for that narrow crowd, the puberty blockers really are reversible. We've been using these medications for decades for children who enter puberty at an age that is early relative to their peers, and where we don't think it's the right time socially. And in those children who would have entered puberty early, where we use these medications, we later, when they are adults, we've been using these medications for decades, so we have adults who've had this experience, we later are not able to find health care concerns attributable to those medications. And so when we say reversible and that these are very safe, it's with enormous confidence.
And you talked about the process that a kid would go through to get these medications. How, before they're prescribed, how do you make sure, as a healthcare professional, how does the system make sure that they are informed, they're consenting, they know as best they can what they're getting into?
The typical process is for the youth, and the parents to go meet with mental health providers, right, for some sort of assessment that this is logical. And remember, these are very safe medications that are reversible. So I'm not too concerned about somebody using these medications for a short time who might be exploring gender identity and then opt out. That really, you know, when you talk about risks and benefits, you act like there are major risks. But when you have virtually no risk and then a significant upside benefit for trans kids, then it's actually an incredibly easy consideration.
Dr. Joshua Safer is with us, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York, talking to us about bills in states around the country that would ban or limit medical treatment for transgender children and adolescents.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or comments about gender-affirming treatment. And if you're a transgender adult, we would love to hear from you. How has transitioning changed your life? How would your life be different if you had been able to transition earlier? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up the conversation about bills banning health care for trans youth in states around the country. Dr. Joshua Safer stays with us, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your comments, your questions, maybe your own experiences. What do you think about this wave of laws limiting, banning, in some cases criminalizing gender-affirming care? Is this something that is affecting your own life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Angie is with us in Madison. Angie, hi.
Hi. I had a question about gender-affirming surgeries for cis kids or gender-affirming procedures. I'm thinking like breast augmentation or breast reduction, or in some cases I know that maybe children who aren't growing to the height that they want to be, and oftentimes this is like boys and young men. receiving growth hormone. I'm just kind of curious, like, where the laws might fall on that and just kind of what your thoughts are on that.
Angie, thanks for the call. Dr. Safer, is there any overlap in those issues that Angie brought up?
I think those are great. That's a great question, and in a sense, great points. In general, we don't have laws with regard to healthcare. In general, that's the whole point for licensing physicians and other healthcare professionals in order to customize situations to the patient and not have some rule that, let's say, you have to use this insulin for diabetes and not that insulin, or whatever the circumstance might be. And so if we're talking about breast augmentation or breast reduction surgeries for a girl who is under 18, that's really a decision between that child and the parents and the physician. And with gender affirming care, you would think it would be the same thing. And in most places it is, but some of these attempts to politicize this are going against that usual framework. And then same for growth hormone that you mentioned. That's a decision that's internal to a family, parents and their children, and with the counsel of their physicians. So a patient physician decision. That's why it's so surprising that there is this attempt to separate out gender affirming care from that usual model.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Safer, you mentioned the politicization of this issue. Florida's health department just issued guidance against gender affirming care to doctors in that state and accused federal guidance, including the CDC and national healthcare groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics, for saying they were politicizing it by their endorsement of these procedures. You've written and tweeted in the opposite direction that these bans are unnecessarily politicizing. How do you weigh the political back and forth on this?
Well, within medicine, there is no political back and forth. that is the Endocrine Society, which is the 18,000 person organization of endocrinologists internationally, based in Washington, D.C., or bigger yet, the American College of Physicians, or bigger yet, the AMA, are all on the same page on this subject, which is, we're data-driven. We do experiments to see what's best. We follow the data and we make the judgments with regard to what's best in terms of medical care across the entire spectrum of medical care. Gender-affirming care fits in that framework. And so unless you want to view all of medicine, all of organized medicine, as being on some side of a political argument, then there is no political argument. And like you've heard me say, it's a mystery to me. That is, medical people do not all share the same politics. If you want to go to a meeting of the AMA or of the Endocrine Society and discuss some of the other issues that we debate in society, you will find people who are Republicans and people who are Democrats and people who are conservative and people who are liberal and so on. But we won't debate that. We use science to inform us for our treatment decisions. And that is true for gender affirming care also.
We're talking to Dr. Joshua Safer, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York, looking at gender affirming care for teens in particular, as states around the country pass or attempt to pass laws against that kind of care. We had a comment through our Wisconsin project. Our writer says, I do not have trans kids. I am the trans person in my family. They go on, at 61, I have yet to receive any more than hormones, though I've pushed for more extensive options with Medicaid. My health care has been interrupted by transphobic providers. My peers have gotten the services I desire long ago, and I feel left behind and regarded as worthless. So our listener looks back on a life of not having received that care. Not an uncommon story, I'm guessing, Dr. Safer.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that story, but you are right. It is a it used to be even a more common story because we weren't providing the care that we needed to be providing. There's been a shift in the establishment medical world in terms of our understanding of gender identity as a biological phenomenon, as for all intents and purposes, part of biological sex. And that has resulted in a shift in our entire approach to care, where we have been able to do better by our patients than we had in the past.
There are probably people listening and people participating in this debate who don't believe that's a thing, that there are only men and there are women, and they don't acknowledge a category aside from that, in between it, wherever on the map. What would you say to them in particular?
Well, our understanding of the complexity of sex or biological sex, and I'm using those words to mean all of that biology that is part of reproduction, our understanding of that complexity has evolved over the years. So once upon a time, we thought it related just to body parts, to anatomy. Then we understood more. We understood chromosomes. We understood genes. And right now in 2022, the model probably has about six categories of components that in order to have reproduction, you know what sex you are, you know your choice of partners, you have certain body parts, you have certain gametes, cells, that is sperm or eggs that can mix for that reproduction. And for most of the population, those are all aligned in a certain way. But we know that each of those pieces is coded by different genes, and people can have some of those genes not aligned with others. We can see it physically in some people. And with regard to gender identity, we couldn't see it, which is why we're late in discovering it. But we certainly can ascertain that to be true. And that's all transgender people are as a person with that particular circumstance.
Time for one more caller. Stella is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Stella, hello.
Hi. I've been very distressed ever since this news came out from the governor of Texas. It seems to me that given the emotional and mental distress that it causes, that it will cause children and adolescents, transgender children and adolescents, if they are denied the medical treatment that they need in order to be at home in their own bodies and their own identity, it seems to me that the governor and any other politicians who propose and who put forward and who pass this kind of legislation that will that would deny these children and prosecute their parents, it seems to me that the child abusers are the governor of Texas and the politicians who put forth and passed this kind of legislation.
Stella, thanks for the call. Just a minute or so left. Dr. Safer, can you talk about the impact on these kids, these adolescents that Stella is worried about?
Well, I share her fear. I share Stella's fear. And I only wish that these politicians that would look to the medical community to inform them in medical care. Texas has great medical institutions. Baylor, University of Texas, Florida, the same. It's not like they need to go to other states even to find experts in care who could help them inform their decisions and make them medical and science-based.
Dr. Safer, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Joshua Safer, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York. He's also senior faculty at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. He talked to us today about bills in states around the country, including some here in Wisconsin, that are aimed at banning medical treatments for transgender youth.
Coming up after the news, a cannabis policy expert joins the show to talk about an effort to legalize medicinal use of marijuana here in Wisconsin. We'll also look at how the state's marijuana laws compare to others around the country. I'm Dean Kinetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Follow these conversations whenever and wherever you are, online at WPR.org, or you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app for live streaming, archives, news, and more. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.